You're listening to Scopes Monkey Choir. Music in a rational universe.
Welcome to episode 62
of Scopes Monkey Choir,
in which Hai Ting interviews a physicist at the University of Michigan.
Yes, we're continuing our series of Hai Ting's interviews on the road. This is going to be a two-parter. This is the first part of her interview with Fred Adams, a physicist of note.
No relation to Douglas, as he himself pointed out.
Mm-hmm. This is a really, really fun conversation. It of course, veers away from our technical topic of podcast, but that, you know...
Yeah, I got to talk to a physicist about star formation and the lifetimes of stars, and which is just so cool that I just couldn't keep myself from asking questions that had nothing to do with music.
As well you should not. Wait. Yes, you did the right thing.
All right, so a little announcement. Come to Science Fair, my project of science in song at the Here Theater. That's H-E-R-E.
.org.
New York. Yes, it's here.org in Soho on Tuesday and Wednesday, the 7th and 8th of February at 8:30. Matthew wrote some of the music. On Tuesday, there will be a discussion with Matthew and another of the composers and with Paige Van Meter of the New York City Skeptics about communicating science and writing music about science and on the, I don't know. What
so
we're
basically,
discuss.
If
come
you're
and
the,
ask questions.
If you're in the New York area, come check out the first workshop.
We'll link to it. Tickets are only $15. It's a work in progress. You can see us stumble around making some music out of science.
Mm-hmm. And here is part one of the interview with Fred Adams.
Yay, Fred Adams.
Yeah, hi, I'm Fred Adams. I teach physics here at the University of Michigan. I'm a professor here. I've been here for 20 years now, and I work on the area of theoretical astrophysics. So over the course of many years, I've worked on many topics in theoretical astrophysics, but I specialize in star and planet formation, and then I spend about a third of my time doing larger scale things like cosmology.
My mind is conjuring up images from Brian Cox's Wonders of the Universe. Is that the sort of thing that you work on planetary disks of dust and how they form themselves into?
Well, it certainly includes that. I have to make a confession that I've actually never seen Brian Cox's.
Oh well, I'm sure you don't need to. You don't need to look at that stuff.
I was almost going to be on his show once, but that's a long story. But it never happened. They were going to film in Detroit, but then they decided to move it from Detroit to Namibia at the last minute. And it turns out that it's easier for me to get to Detroit than Africa, so I wasn't actually.
Yeah, they do seem to take any excuse to go to some exotic locale and...
Well, I thought Detroit was nice and interesting but and even exotic, but they didn't go for that. So anyway, the answer is yes. I do work on things that are like that. So to put it in perspective, some of the biggest questions in astrophysics are really the origin of everything. And you can divide astrophysics into different scales. There's the universe, so the origin of the universe in Big Bang Theory. There's the formation of galaxies within, or in structure within the universe. Then within galaxies, there's the formation of stars, which are the fundamental engines that drive all the energy in the cosmos, or create all the energy in the cosmos. And then there's planets around them. And we care about planets not for their astronomical importance so much as for their human importance, that planets are the one place that we do live, and they're the one place that we could live. So everybody's interested in planets because of that reason.
Yeah, there are all these citizen science things now going on with looking for planets, besides the more highly scientific Kepler staring at space and looking for transits and gravitational... What is the other method of finding planets?
Well, there's four methods of finding planets. Oh. There's what's called the radial velocity method. That's where you have a planet that's orbiting a star, and the orbit of the planet causes the star to wobble back and forth a little bit. And by measuring that wobble, you can deduce the orbital properties of the planet. Mm-hmm. That's the radial velocity method. There's the transit method, wherein the planet actually goes in front of the star and casts a shadow on the star. So if you're just monitoring the star, when the planet casts a shadow in front of it, the star gets a little bit dimmer.
But then you have to wait for it to come back around to see.
Right, and it will come. But the cool thing is that many of these planets are in very close orbits, where close means 4 days.
Uh-huh.
So it will be dim every 4 days. Well, that's something you can measure. It takes about 4 days. Actually, you have to have a couple orbits, so it takes 8 or 12 or 16 days. But you don't have to wait forever. Then there's the microlensing way. We talked earlier, even though you missed it on your tape, we talked earlier about how relativity tells you that light gets bent around masses. So we see what's called microlensing, where background stars have light that's bent around foreground stars, which we then see at Earth.
Right.
So then if you add a planet to that intermediate planet or intermediate star, then you see a different signature in the microlensing amplification.
So it's not about the light of the star that has the planet bent around the
planet. The star and its planet form a lens, and the star way behind it gets amplified by that star in the foreground, which is the lens. The planet basically plays the role of an imperfection in the lens.
It's a little mote in that eye.
Yeah, you get a little bit of a glitch in the in the curve, and it's the properties of that glitch that actually give you the properties of the planet.
Basically. The spectral properties of it.
Well, it's an amplification with time, so you see the as the foreground star passes in front of the background star. The background star's light gets amplified, so you see an increase in its brightness and then a decrease back to normal. But that shape of that curve gets little glitches in it if you have planets, too. You get extra little bits of amplification. But the planet has to be in just the right place for that to happen. In fact, the stars have to be in just the right place for that to happen. So what you do is you monitor gazillions of these things, and occasionally you get a lens, and then occasionally of the occasionally you get a planet, too.
Gazillion, that's a
technical term.
Yes, of course. And you said there were four?
Yes, the fourth is you actually take a picture of them. Which is called imaging. And there are only a few cases where you have big, bright, young planets relatively far from their stars, where they're big and bright enough and you can get the contrast down so you can actually take a picture of them. So there's only a handful, and they're all young, because things are brighter when they're young.
Okay. Stars and planets.
Yes.
Why are planets brighter when they're young?
Well, because they haven't cooled down yet. Basically, if you take a bunch of gas, one way or another, however you make it, and you ball it all together to make either a star or a planet, you get a lot of heat out.
And heat that equals heat light.
And that heat is energy. And what's surprising, that all makes sense. Everyone has an intuition for that. What doesn't resonate usually with most people who aren't scientists is that it takes a long time for that heat to leak out. If you look at Earth, you think, well, most of the energy that we get is from the sun, which is true. But we actually have an internal energy source. Now, we're not exactly sure exactly how much of it, we know the total, but it's from two sources. One is from radioactivity, and the other is from heat left over from when the Earth was made. And different papers, different textbooks will give you different values for the ratio of those two sources, but they're about comparable. Which means they're measurable, which means after 4.6 billion years, we still have heat left over from when we made the Earth. Well, we didn't make it, but when our Earth
when
was made.
It was made, it, yes.
Yes, yes.
What is the difference between, it isn't radioactivity really just heat left over from when the Earth was made?
No, there's two things. If you take gas and you pull it together, just compress it, it heats up. Right?
So that's
That's heat, okay?
But
radioactivity is different, okay? If you have a big nucleus, like uranium, it can break apart and give up energy. The nucleus can break apart spontaneously and give up energy. If you make them all break apart at once, you get a bomb, right? And we have the technology, unfortunately, to do that. But in addition to making it induced, you can have nuclei just break apart gradually by themselves, spontaneously.
Radioactive decay.
And that's what radioactive decay is. And that happens naturally. Different species of nuclei will decay over vastly different amounts of time, from far less than a second to the age of the Earth.
But those heavy elements were not formed as the Earth came together.
No, they were pre-existing. They have to be formed in stars.
Because that's the only place where there's enough density to
There's enough energy to form them.
Bigger nuclei together.
Right. loosely speaking, there's two. Well, there's actually three. I sound like Mighty Python. There's actually four. There's different ways to make nuclei. The Big Bang, early in the universe, makes all our helium. Uh-huh. Or not all of our helium, most of our helium. Okay, but
that's the simplest.
Yes.
Atom.
Yes, we go from hydrogen as the simplest atom because it's just protons, and then a helium nucleus has two protons and two neutrons. And it turns out about 25%, actually now about 28%, of the universe is made of helium by mass.
Well, when did that change happen?
What's that?
From 25 to 28, our understanding of how much helium is.
Oh, well, the story, where those two numbers were coming from in my little head, is that the Big Bang, which is the first 3 minutes, of the universe. During the first 3 minutes of the universe, the early universe produces or processes about 25% of the mass from hydrogen into helium. Mm-hmm. Okay, so when the universe is at the ripe old age of 3 minutes, it contains about 25% helium.
Okay.
Then all the stars and all the galaxies over all of time since then produce more helium, right? Because the sun shines by burning hydrogen into helium, right? That's why we have sunlight. That's why we're here. Right?
Fusion, nuclear.
Nuclear fusion does that.
Okay.
In both cases, nuclear fusion does that. But all the stars over all the galaxies over all that time produce less helium than those first 3 minutes of the Big Bang.
Mm.
So in rough terms, you get 25% of the helium in 3 minutes, and then you get another couple percent in the 13.7 billion years since then.
So were other heavier elements made in the Big Bang, or just
no,
helium?
Because the helium has a bigger charge than the hydrogen.
Mm.
So in order to make helium fuse into bigger things like carbon and oxygen, you need higher temperatures and higher densities.
Than in the Big Bang,
yes.
Interesting.
So in the Big Bang, you have enough time, temperature, and density to get from hydrogen to helium.
Didn't you have to get from just nothing to hydrogen as well?
Well, in some sense, you have to get from quarks to... Which you do.
Quarks to protons and electrons, and then,
But you don't have enough oomph, which is all those things, the temperature and the time under that confinement and the density, to get to higher elements, higher atomic numbers. When you get to stars, like our sun, are burning hydrogen into helium. When they evolve further, and our sun will do this eventually, it will start burning its helium into carbon and oxygen.
Hmm.
Okay.
And it will have a higher heat and density?
Hotter temperature in the center and a higher density in its center, but it will only last in that configuration for a much shorter time.
Okay.
And for the case of the sun, after it burns its hydrogen or its helium into carbon and oxygen, it will kind of peter out because it doesn't have enough mass to crush its core to a high enough density and temperature to burn those elements into silicon and so on.
Okay.
But bigger stars do. They have enough mass. And they will burn their carbon and oxygen into silicon and their silicon into iron.
Mm-hmm.
Now, once you get to iron, there ain't nowhere to go.
You're using the word burn.
Yes. But I mean burned by the process of nuclear fusion.
Okay.
That's the astronomer shorthand because we don't like to say by the process of nuclear fusion. So we mean nuclear burning, right?
Uh-huh. Okay.
Now, here's the deal. There's actually two ways to do nuclear reactions. There's fission and fusion. So we know that if we take hydrogen and we bash them together to make helium, that's a fusion reaction. We can make a fusion bomb.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, we can. And that gives us energy. We also know we can make a fission bomb. We can take uranium, we can break that apart and get energy out and make a fission bomb. So the question that you want to ask yourself is, how can that be? How can I take little things, or how can I take things and mash them together and get energy, and how can I take nuclei and pull them apart and get energy?
Indeed.
And the key to that, which I just gave away, is that to get energy out, you'd have to take little things and mash them together and big things and break them apart.
Mm.
So if you imagine there's this valley that at low atomic numbers, when you make nuclei bigger, you get energy out. And at high atomic numbers, when you break them apart, you get energy out. Somewhere in the middle, there has to be a lowest energy where you don't get energy out anymore. The way physicists say that is that's the atomic nucleus with the highest binding energy. It's that middle of the valley. And it's actually a fairly common element. It's called iron. Mm-hmm. So if you're a star and you've burned all your lighter elements into iron, you can't get any more energy out by burning the iron because the iron doesn't burn. Because there's no energy to be gained. It costs energy to make nuclei bigger than iron. Mm-hmm. So what happens is that big stars burn their cores to iron. Long story short is they then explode. And they explode and they spew stuff left, right, and sideways across the universe.
That's a supernova.
And that's a supernova. Exactly right. Now, in the supernova, you have all this iron and nickel and related elements, and you have all these alpha particles, which are just helium nuclei, and you have neutrons, and they all hit each other. Uh-huh. Now, sometimes the iron will absorb neutrons and alpha particles and move up to higher atomic numbers. It costs energy to do that, but it will do that sometimes. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes those heavier elements will take more neutrons and move further up. Mm-hmm. So you can populate the periodic table all the way up to uranium through this bootstrapping process. Mm. And that's how we get all of the elements bigger than iron.
Now, when a supernova explodes like that, is it enough force that it's literally just an iron atom here and another one here, or are there little chunks of iron out in space at that point?
Oh, there's not like iron nuggets or ingots out there.
Little gold ingots out in space.
No, it's more, they're basically very little in the way of solids, right? Uh-huh. It's all in the gas phase, right?
Okay.
So, and as far as these nuclear processes that I'm loosely describing go, it all happens on a particle-by-particle basis.
Okay.
What makes a solid is that the atoms get together and actually have some coherent crystalline structure. Well, it doesn't have to be crystalline, but some coherent structure of which crystalline is one kind, mm-hmm. right? And that's what makes a solid a solid, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is just on particle-by-particle basis, right?
But also in a star, there aren't really solids.
It's all gas.
Plasmic state.
Yeah, in fact, what's kind of amazing about stars is that there's all these exotic forms of pressure that you can imagine. But stars, when they're in their main nuclear burning phase, burning hydrogen into helium, as we talked about earlier, their pressure is given by something called the ideal gas law, which is what you learned about in high school chemistry.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, of course, yes.
Yes.
Unless I wasn't paying attention that day.
But you learned about it, you just haven't used it a lot since.
I haven't. I'm trying now. I'm trying to do better.
Yes. But anyway, the ideal gas law is rather mundane in the sense that that's everyday physics, right? That's what happens to the air. That's what describes the pressure and the temperature of the air in this room.
Okay.
But it's also what describes the middle of a star.
Oh.
Because there are other forms of pressure, like radiation. But when a star gets to the point where it has enough radiation that the radiation pressure matters, then the star's no longer stable and it can't burn anymore because it kind of blows itself apart.
Okay.
What it really does is adjust itself to stability and then obeys the ideal gas law again. On the other end, if you make it too cold and too dense, then something called quantum mechanical degeneracy pressure beats the ideal gas law. But when that happens, you can't squeeze the gas to high enough temperature to sustain the nuclear reactions, and the star shuts off. So the low mass end of the stellar range is determined by degeneracy pressure, where you get brown dwarfs, and the high mass end is determined by radiation pressure, where you get unstable stars, and in between, where you have real stars, you get the behavior governed by the ideal gas law.
Excellent. So does a brown dwarf become a solid, or is there solids in it, or does it just stop generating? Stop the fusion reactions?
That's a very good question, and the answer is both. What happens is that when you make a brown dwarf, which is degenerate, or you make a white dwarf, which is what happens when the sun dies, which is also degenerate, when they're first made, there's enough heat left over that it's in the gaseous phase. So it's like a gas of degenerate gas. Okay? Mm-hmm. But if you wait long enough, it cools.
Okay.
So if you take a white dwarf and you let it cool, it will crystallize and form a crystalline lattice of often carbon. What is a crystalline lattice of often carbon, or mostly carbon?
A planet?
Well, crystalline carbon is called diamond.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah, so a white dwarf after it's very, very
becomes
cold,
a diamond planet. Oh my God, we have to go out and find them.
It becomes a diamond star.
It literally becomes a huge mass of diamond.
More or less.
Uh-huh.
It's sort of a self-gravitating diamond, so it's a little different.
Have we observed and
yes,
these cooled white dwarfs? And
yeah, well, we think so. I mean, we've seen lots of white dwarfs, right? And what we do is we look at how fast, we think we know how fast they cool.
Mm-hmm.
So if you know how often stars form and how long they live, then you can determine how often they die. And then you can determine the time since they died. And when they die, they turn into these white dwarfs, mm-hmm. right? So by looking at how bright they are and how hot they are, you can see how long it's been since they died,
mm-hmm.
if you understand the cooling. And by doing that, you can figure out the age of the galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
So we think in order to do that calculation, we have to let the older ones crystallize, like we talked about briefly, to get the cooling rates correct. And when you do that, you get the right age of the galactic disk, which is 10 billion years.
Does that mean that the white dwarfs had to have been among the first stars in the galaxy?
Oh, no. You form stars from the beginning of the galaxy to now. We're forming stars now.
Right.
That's why I'm in business, right? Because star formation. And my thesis was on looking for the infrared signature of stars that are forming now.
Okay.
And the fact that I was able to calculate the infrared signature of stars that are forming now, and we could then look at that infrared signature and go, oh, match them up. That's why I have a job, so it's
okay.
Good. But stars form continuously to zeroth order, and people fight about exactly the statement, but they form at sort of a constant rate. The galaxy forms sort of one solar mass of stars per year. It's kind of like one star a year.
Okay.
But, you know, we've been around for 10 billion years, so we have 10 billion stars, right?
So it's not that we have found, it's not that you know that those particular stars are the oldest in the galaxy, you're just doing a kind of...
Well, no, what you do is you imagine, let's take the simplest case where you form a star a year, okay?
Okay.
Which is a gross simplification, but go with that. Then some fraction of them die each year because they come in different masses. And then the ones that die, the biggest ones die first, it turns out. And then those will actually cool the fastest, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there will be a distribution of ages of white dwarfs, but there will be an oldest white dwarf, which will be the coolest white dwarf, as in the coldest, not the grooviest. Okay? And by finding that distribution of white dwarfs and their brightnesses and their temperatures and whatnot, you can figure out what the coolest one is, which is the oldest one, and thereby date the galaxy.
To at least a certain age?
Yes.
Okay. So wait, brown dwarfs, you just told me that the white dwarfs decay into crystalline...
Diamonds, yeah.
Diamond. And the brown dwarfs?
Well, the brown dwarfs are made primarily of hydrogen. See, the brown dwarfs are born with too little mass to burn hydrogen into helium, so they just stay in the form of hydrogen. So they don't do much. They're kind of like stellar slackers. They just sit around.
They just become a ball of
so they're
hydrogen.
Yeah, they're born as a ball of degenerate hydrogen gas, or mostly degenerate hydrogen gas, and they just sit around and don't do anything. But what they do is they cool. So if you wait long enough, the hydrogen can crystallize.
Huh.
But that will take longer. So I actually do not know exactly how long that takes off the top of my head. But
well, why not?
Well, every once in a while there's something I just don't know. We could look it up. We could calculate it, but I don't know off the top of my head.
Well, I'll leave that for another day. But I want to ask you about something that we've dealt with, my co-host and I, as musicians, and which is the idea of the harmonic series. And as we were looking into the harmonic series, we found reference to the idea that any vibrating body, including a star, generates a harmonic series because it's just a matter of ratios of waves. Can you say anything about that? Like, for instance, what does it mean for there to be waves within a spherical mass like that, and whether they would be then projected into space in some way as electromagnetic waves or as actual waves in some kind of material? Or does any of this make any sense, or is it...
No, you're making perfect sense. The problem we'll have in answering your question is that you've just asked 30 questions.
Whoa. So, oh. All right,
so,
pick one.
So we'll give you a couple of answers on that. So the answer is that if you have any physical system, whether it's a star, a planet, a disk of a galaxy, or a bell, or a violin, or a trumpet, it likes to vibrate. Mm-hmm. And it likes to vibrate in certain ways. And we call the modes of vibration modes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you're probably familiar with something like a violin string. So it's about this long.
And it, feet, yeah.
Yeah, and it has a fundamental mode, mm-hmm. which is
right.
a wavelength that, for a string, a half a wavelength goes the entire string mm-hmm. length. Mm-hmm. We don't worry about factors of two. Right. But the idea is you can put one wave on it, or two-humped wave, or a three-humped wave on it, and so
yes.
on. So you get the first mode, and the first mm-hmm. overtone, and the second one, and mm-hmm. so on. And musicians have names for these, right?
Yes, you pretty much just said them.
Yes.
And musicians can disagree about them all they want.
Yeah, yeah.
We actually did a couple of episodes on the harmonic series as it relates to just actual sound within an atmosphere generated
right,
by...
Right, so violin strings have the series of modes. Organ pipes have a different series of modes because they're, you can have an organ pipe that's open on one end and closed on the other, or closed on both ends, and you get different...
And because it's a matter
the boundary
of longitudinal waves also rather than...
Yeah. Transverse waves, yes.
Yes.
You absolutely
transverse
right.
Yeah.
Right, right. So, but all these things like to vibrate and have their modes. And for musical things like violins and organ pipes and trumpets, those vibrations get one way or another turned into sound waves that then you can experience with your ears.
Which
right?
is a compression of molecules in the medium, whether it's air
yeah, usually
or
it's
water.
Air.
Or, yeah.
yeah. Could be water. Could be cement, but
right.
you don't play too many concerts in cement. But.
And not too many people's ears are in cement listening, hopefully.
Yeah, usually by the time they get to cement, they're not listening
yeah,
anymore.
Exactly.
You are in New York City, right?
Yes, I'm. But yeah.
Oh.
Thanks again, Fred Adams.
Part two will be next week, and the fascinating conversation will continue.
Come to Science Fair at the Here Theater.
Thank you for listening to Scopes Monkey Choir from ScopesMonkeyChoir.com.
We are professional musicians, but not scientists.
But he was a scientist.
He was definitely a scientist. So if you doubt something that we've said, call up Fred Adams and ask him if it's correct.
Right. Poor Fred.
Leave us a review on iTunes or call us on the monkey phone if you want to be on the podcast.
347-788-0330.
Hey, did you memorize that? wait, what was I saying? We're professional musicians, not science. I tweet at Scopes Monkeys.
I tweet at Squid Octo, though I've been taking a little bit of a Twitter break.
Oh, Twitter break for Squid Octo. Come see us on Tuesday and Wednesday.
Hmm.
Ha!